The RAF's nighttime attacks on dams in northwest Germany on May the 16th and 17th in 1943 were among its most audacious raids of the war. Why it carried out the raids and what they achieved are the subjects of a book called Chastised, The Dambuster Story 1943. The author, historian Max Hastings, is in our London studio. Max Hastings, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Good morning, Sean.
Thank you indeed. Good to talk to you. And there's something else I want to talk to you about at the end, or somebody else. We'll get on to that, but... you write about how Churchill, at this stage in the war, he wanted a spectacular, a piece of what you call military theatre, as he used to say. Why was he so keen on that at this point?
Well, Churchill himself wasn't directly involved in Operation Chastise until afterwards, when he was absolutely thrilled. But what one has to remember, if you really sort of cut to the chase about the history of the Second World War, is that between the British Army being kicked out of France in 1940 and D-Day in 1944, all the operations the British Army was involved were pretty small potatoes, that the Russians were doing all the heavy lifting of fighting the Germans. And Churchill all the time knew that the biggest problem, British morale, that it held up pretty well, but people by 1943, they knew that what was going on in Italy and before that in North Africa was terribly insignificant compared with the Russian front. They felt pretty depressed about their own country. And every night they were told that the RAF was bombing Germany. They were told that the Royal Navy was doing a terrific job, which it was, holding open the Atlantic sea routes. But more and more, they felt themselves being marginalised in the war after their great stand in 1940 alongside the Americans and the Russians. And Churchill understood that to keep a sense of purpose in the British war effort, what I call military theatre, things that seemed to be important and terrific, even if they weren't quite as important as they terrific, were immensely valuable. So Operation Chastise, the attack on the dams, although it made far less impact on German industry than they'd all hoped when they launched it, it was a terrific boost to the morale of British people and to British prestige in the United States, where it had fallen pretty low.
And what about the strategic importance of these dams and the difficulty of attacking them?
It was fantastically difficult to attack them because they're so huge that right from the beginning of the war, the RAF's chiefs understood that if they could break the dams, that it could make a devastating impact on rural industry, because to make steel and to run mines, you need enormous quantities of water. The problem was, and the Ministry of Economic Warfare in London identified this, the Mona Dam was by far the biggest. Terrific. Sir Charles Portal, the head of the RAF, said, let's break the Mona Dam. But, said the Ministry of Economic Warfare, there's a problem, that although it will make an almighty mess if we can break the Mona, that in order really, really to affect the German war effort, you've also got to break the Sorpy Dam 9 miles away. Trouble. Barnes Wallis, this brilliant engineer, has devised these so-called bouncing bombs with which to attack the dams at very low level. But the Sorpy is an earth dam with a sloping wall, which you can't bounce bombs off. So they knew when they launched this raid that although they, if they were very lucky and the crews were incredibly skillful and brave, they might be able to break the Mona, that if they couldn't break the Sorpy, which wasn't very likely, then German industry wasn't going to be much affected. But they went ahead anyway, because almost all military operations, you go ahead anyway, even if you don't have a guaranteed success.
And another key figure and an influential one in this story is was Sir Arthur Harris. Remind us about his significance.
Sir Arthur Harris, nicknamed Bomber Harris, whom I interviewed back in 1977 for a very early book I did on Bomber Command. He was the commander-in-chief of Bomber Command. He was a monster. Monsters can be useful in wars of national survival. But Harris made up his mind that the way to win the war, and remember, when he took over at the beginning of 1942, again, the British Army wasn't doing much. He believed that you could win the war by burning the cities of Germany wholesale. And he set out in 1942 to burn the cities of Germany, and by 1945, he'd been pretty successful in doing that. And his ruthlessness and the way he set about this was pretty scary. And even more, he resented the diversion of even a single one of his aircraft doing anything else. So when Sir Charles Portal came to him and said, I want you to dedicate a squadron to attack these dams with this wonderful new bouncing bomb, Harris wanted no part of it. He sent devastating memos to the Air Ministry saying, this is tripe of the wildest kind. I'm not having my Lancasters diverted to doing this. Get these people locked up.
But nonetheless, he didn't get his way. 17 Lancaster bombers set off on the moonlit night of May the 16th. How did they get on?
It's hard to overstate. I mean, I'm still moved, even after all these years, by the extraordinary courage. These very young people, they were gap year age, or most students at uni, that the best pilot on the squadron, John Hopgood, in Gibson's view, Guy Gibson, who was commanding the squadron, was John Hopgood was 21 years old. But he was a veteran, and he was already, his sister described how he was already showing terribly the strain of all that he'd already been through and was being asked to do. But these kids, they felt, and they were kids, the words duty and God, which often arouse derision and get comedians talking in the 21st century, to that generation it was terribly important. And their sense of duty, they were told, frankly, very extravagantly, if not deceitfully, by their commanders, that if they could succeed in breaking these dams, it was going to shorten the war. Well, actually, even the air marshals never really believed it would do this. But they took off on the night of May the 16th, 1943. 19 aircraft took off. Well, one, they were flying at 0 feet over the North Sea. One, I call them, said the planes were virtually kissing the waves. One of them, the pilot slipped just for a second. Plane touches the waves, the bomb's torn off the bottom of the plane, water pours into the plane, terrifying for the crew. Well, miraculously, the Lancaster survived, but he has to turn back. As they cross the Dutch coast, that another Lancaster's hit by anti-aircraft fire, and they're flying so low, all its communications knocked out. You can't do this sort of attack, not even able to the crew to speak to each other. They have to turn back. Two more crews hit power cables that they're flying so low that they're flying right into these power cables. That's the end of them. All the crews killed. Another crew blinded by a searchlight. Pilot can't see, crashes straight into the ground. But miraculously, eight crews make it to the Mona Dam, and one by one they launch their attacks. And it was quite extraordinary. They've got anti-aircraft fire coming up at them. It's moonlight, but it's still night. And for 42 minutes, Guy Gibson and his planes circle that dam, and then one by one they go into attack. And one, two, three, the first three of them fail. And the second one, John Hopgood, best pilot on the squadron, and he's hit by anti-aircraft fire. His plane crashes a minute later. Another very fine Australian pilot, Mickey Martin, whom I met years ago when I was writing Bomber Command, and Mickey Martin, terrific pilot, but his plane's hit by anti-aircraft fire as he's just about to release his bomb. His bomb doesn't work either. First three crews, that they do exactly what Barnes Wallis wanted them to do, but not quite with the precision that they had to do to make these bombs work. So they're pretty demoralized at that moment. But then the fourth plane, flown by a pilot called Young, Melvin Young, who'd been an Oxford oarsman, and he was always known as Dinghy Young because he'd survived ditching planes twice in the sea and once survived 21 hours in a dinghy. So all these people are sort of actuarially dead before they start all this business because they survived so much already. Dinghy Young makes a perfect drop, and as he pulls away and the bomb explodes, he says, "I think I've done it." But for a few seconds, a minute or two, the dam still holds, and the fifth plane goes on in and drops its bomb, and just as it drops its bomb and the bomb explodes, suddenly the whole dam goes, and almost certainly Dinghy Young's bomb had blown the dam. And this dam, suddenly there's a huge breach and a torrent, what I've called a biblical flood, is unleashed. Now, so far, this is the conventional story as told in that most popular of all British war movies, The Dam Busters. But what I've tried to do also, in the 21st century, I think we can still have the admiration for the huge courage of the crews and for the achievement of Barnes Wallis. But we also have to look at what happened in Germany underneath this. And that's what I've tried to do. We have to, we've stopped being nationalistic about this. This biblical flood, what it did to the German people underneath, is a terrifying story.
How many people died?
Somewhere between 1,200 and 1,400, the great irony, over half of them were female slave labourers in a camp beneath the Mona. About 1,000 of them lived in this camp, Ukrainian and Polish and Russian girls who've been driven from their homes to come and work in dreadful conditions, living off turnip soup for the Nazi war effort. And they, behind barbed wire, had no means of escape from this terrifying flood, a tidal wave 40 feet high, sweeping down. And the people, the survivors, they tell stories of these terrible screams and of the ruins of their huts tumbling down on the top of this great wave, with some women struggling in them. The stories, the human stories of what happened to those people under this. And, of course, the floods extended nearly 100 miles up below the Mona.
And did it shorten the war, as those young fighter pilots were told it would?
No. I think the cynicism, maybe this is what you have to do in war to get men to do terrible things and incredibly dangerous things, that there was a shocking cynicism when they knew perfectly well that the chances of... But the fact the Sorpy Dam survived the attack, but they broke the Mona and the Ada, and, of course, it made headlines all over the world. And Churchill, who was in Washington then with the chiefs of staff, he'd become so accustomed to having to break bad news to the Americans about how the British couldn't do this or that, had failed to do this and that. And suddenly, here was a brilliant success, a marriage of British imagination and technology and courage. And here am I, who've now lived into my 70s, and I'm so moved by what those kids did. And by the end of the war, 133 young men who took off for Germany in May 1943, by 1945, just 32 of them were still alive.
Extraordinary sacrifices there, both imposed and suffered by people in the air and people on the ground. Max, I want to ask you about another Prime Minister, the one who is currently in 10 Downing Street, a man who is also, of course, as we know, a Churchill biographer, Boris Johnson. As he was about to become leader of the Tory party, you wrote an article which was headed, "I was Boris Johnson's boss." That was when you were editor of the Daily Telegraph. "He is utterly unfit to be Prime Minister. Has he lived down to your expectations?"
I keep hoping, for the sake of our poor country, that things will turn out better than I feared that they would. But so far, there's not much evidence of it. That I'm tempted to say sometimes that my business, mostly these days, is writing about historical tragedies rather than with our contemporary tragedy. But it breaks my heart to see Britain embarked on this course, and especially because I believe that British politicians, and notably Boris Johnson, and some of the not very impressive people around him, seem completely indifferent to the implications for the whole island of Ireland. And one does tremble for the danger of the Troubles resurgence, which, of course, I saw as a young reporter back in the late 1960s. And the sheer insouciance and carelessness with which the British are approaching this. I'm afraid Brexit is driven by an almost crazy... We were hearing earlier about Downton Abbey and nostalgia. Nostalgia, here am I who write history books, but I never suffer from nostalgia. I never kid myself that it was better to live in the Second World War or better to live in the time of Downton Abbey. And these people, they think we can lead a dash to the past. They think that if we can just rebuild the Britain of the past, that this is going to be great for Britain. I don't share that view at all. We are not an important country anymore, and we're going to find it very lonely out there, and I feel a desperate sorry for the troubles this is bringing on Ireland.
Quick question to you. Does it trouble you as well that the paper which you edited is in fact Boris Johnson's loudest cheerleader, The Telegraph?
I'm afraid that the British press comes out of this whole story very badly, that a number of newspaper proprietors, most of them who don't even live in Britain, have allowed their titles or encouraged their titles to act, I think, recklessly irresponsibly. And I wrote last Saturday in the Financial Times that Boris Johnson is peddling a budget of falsehoods and unfulfillable promises, which I fear are going to lead us into terrible trouble. And yes, I'm afraid he's done nothing so far to change my view that he's wholly unfit to be our Prime Minister. And this is a tragic time for our country.
Max Hastings, thank you so much indeed for joining us. That book is called Chastise, The Dambuster Story, 1943, published by William Collins.